It's estimated that in the United States, people with disabilities constitute the third largest and perhaps the most diverse minority group. A person may be born with a disability or it may occur during a lifetime. The disability can be physical, cognitive, mental, sensory, emotional, developmental, or a combination of all of these. I'm Laura Spencer. Today on Central Standard, we'll talk about disability issues across the lifespan, the challenges and success stories. Also in this hour, self-determination, attitudes and abilities, including self-awareness, creativity, problem-solving, and self-advocacy skills. For the disability community, self-determination means having the same rights as all people, for freedom, authority, and support to exercise control over their own lives. That's ahead on Central Standard, right after the news. Times have changed when it comes to understanding and responding to those with disabilities. Today, family members and the community play a crucial role providing support and care from an early age into adulthood. Good morning, I'm Laura Spencer, and this is Central Standard. Today, we're taking a look at disability issues across the age spectrum and self-determination. Individuals with disabilities making things happen in their own lives. Our guests this hour are Dr. Kathy Fuger. She's the Director of Early Childhood and Youth Programs at UMKC Institute for Human Development. Thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you.
Also, Dr. Carl Calkins, he's the Director of the UMKC Institute for Human Development, also a Professor of Psychology. Thank you for being here this morning.
You're welcome. Thank you for having us.
And Dr. Mike Waymire, he's a Professor of Special Education and a Director of KU's Center on Developmental Disabilities. Good morning.
Hi, Laura.
I wonder, maybe I'll just have Dr. Calkins and Dr. Waymire just talk just briefly a little bit about each of your organizations and their specialties, just for people who aren't familiar with your organizations.
Sure. Mike, want to go ahead?
We both direct centers that are part of a national network of what are referred to as University Centers for Excellence in Developmental Disabilities. These centers are funded by the Federal Developmental Disabilities Act that funds in each state a network of agencies and centers that focus on providing supports to people with developmental disabilities and their families to live fuller, richer lives. And in each state, there is a university center, which is obviously based out of a university and focuses on research and interdisciplinary training and information dissemination. And also part of that federally funded network is a protection and advocacy agency that focuses on legal issues, and then a state planning council that looks at systems change in the state.
So the university centers are really what President Kennedy's vision was when he set up the initial legislation, is a place where you would go from research to practice, where families and others could find out what are the best things that are happening in the field, what do their children need, what are people with adults with disabilities need to really support them to living full lives in the community.
Okay, and we'll get into President Kennedy and some of that legislation a little bit later.
Yeah.
I wanted to, we were talking, in this hour we'll be talking about disability throughout the lifespan, and I wanted to turn to Kathy Fuger as someone who your work focuses on children from birth to age 8. And could you talk about some of the major risk factors when it comes to developmental disabilities?
Certainly. I think certainly there are congenital disabilities and others that early diagnosis is important, and some of that happens in neonatology units in the hospital. But in addition to that, there are many environmental risks that can either exacerbate disabilities or make children at higher risk for having developmental delays of some sort. The poor nutrition or poor prenatal care for their mothers during pregnancy, substance abuse within the family, mental health issues within the family. Many of the issues are family systems issues. When parents have insufficient education or there's been a lot of domestic violence, all of those things add to risks for children's optimal development.
Well, one of the projects that I read about that your program has worked with was a project at Children's Mercy Hospital called TIES, mm-hmm. and it got its start in 1989. It's an acronym for Team for Infants Endangered by Substance Abuse. And could you talk about that program and kind of your role with that?
It's a fun one for me to talk about. I did my dissertation on a study of the social support of the women in that program and had opportunities early on in interviewing them. And it started out as a randomized comparison group design with healthcare through the hospital. And over the years, it has always included an intensive home visitation program that linked with many other community supports, and numerous of those features have continued to be strengthened, and more applied research and implementation study has occurred. And to this date now, the model is really, I think, become articulated in a way for replication, which is occurring right now in the state of Kansas. It started in the Missouri side, and with some of the funding for home visitation right now is being replicated in Kansas.
So are you involved then on the Kansas side too?
Our involvement has been with the program evaluation throughout all those years, and then we've been involved in the implementation study and an upcoming effectiveness study on the Kansas side as well.
And how have you seen families involved in that program? I mean, I know that it started, I guess there was a it was identified as a need after testing of infants, and then it seems like it would have to be a whole family initiative.
A family approach, yes. In fact, I think one of the best things about working at the Institute for Human Development is that we have strong underpinnings of what principles that we will work on, and things that are family-centered and strengths-based and building on the natural assets that families have, and starting there and really realizing that children are never isolated from the ecology around them of families and their neighborhoods and their communities, and that we have to look at children in context.
That's Dr. Kathy Fugger. She's the director of the Early Childhood and Youth Programs at the UMKC Institute for Human Development. Also in the studio, Dr. Carl Calkins of the UMKC Institute for Human Development and Mike Waymeyer of the Kansas University Center on Developmental Disabilities. Do you or a family member have a disability? What are the most important changes you'd like to see in perceptions about the disabled? You can join the conversation. It's 816-235-2888, or you can send us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. I wanted to go back a little bit when we touched on this briefly about legislation, and I think when a lot of people think of disability legislation, they think of the Americans with Disability Act of 1990,
right.
But it's interesting how there's more recent legislation, but also legislation dating back to the 1960s. And I'd read that in 1961, President John F. Kennedy convened a panel to investigate issues people with developmental disabilities faced. And could you talk a little bit about what it was like for people with developmental disabilities in the 1960s?
Yeah, I was there, I guess. The issues relate to what we know about disabilities, what are the best practices that encourage people to develop and grow, what are the most supportive environments. In the 60s, there were limitations on the expectations and limitations of programs. I think today we find a much different set of expectations for individuals with disabilities. Excuse me. So that they can not only grow and develop, but what are the most supportive environments? What are the most important support networks for people? And what are the expectations that we have? I think the thing that's exciting about Mike's work and my work with the National Gateway on Self-Determination is the expectation is that individuals with disabilities will be contributing members of society. They'll have the ability to make decisions, to make choices in their life, and really take responsibility. And that's what our national center, we have a National Gateway, which is a program that Mike and I are co-principal investigators of, has really built a body of research and practice over the last 5 years, and we hope to continue this over the next several years, to find ways in all different areas of life, from health care, to employment, to community living, that practices can really help people, not only help individuals with disabilities not only take responsibility, but what are the ways to help them not only build the skills, but provide supportive environments so people expect that.
Mike, did you want to add anything about legislation?
Right. I think the thing to realize is there have been pretty dramatic changes over really the last quarter century. In the early part of the 20th century, what developed in America was a state-run institutional system in which people with intellectual and developmental disabilities lived, had very few other options. There were no expectations for community-based involvement. To give an example, the census, the American census on the number of people living in institutions run by states, peaked in the late 1970s at about 250,000 people across the United States who lived in institutions, large institutions. At the same time, there were fewer than 300 community-based homes and agencies to support people to live in their communities. Today, many, many states have closed down all of their institutions. There are fewer than 25,000 people living in large institutions, and more than 600,000 people with developmental disabilities receiving supports to live, learn, work, and play in their community. So it's been a dramatic change, particularly in where people live. The change has been less dramatic in where people work, although we do have ways and models and strategies that can support people with developmental disabilities to work alongside their non-disabled peers in meaningful work. And that's you know, I think the expectation today, then, Carl's point about expectations, is that people with developmental disabilities should have the right and the opportunity to live with their neighbors, to go to school at the same school that the other kids in the neighborhood go to, and to expect to be able to seek and get a job. And so
I just wanted to say you're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Laura Spencer, and we just heard from Dr. Mike Waymeyer. He's the professor of special education and director of KU Center on Developmental Disabilities. Also in the studio, Dr. Carl Calkins, director of the UMKC Institute for Human Development, and Dr. Kathy Fugger. And Carl, you wanted to add something?
Well, I think just the notion the Americans with Disabilities Act really outlines the protections and the safeguards that need to be in place so that people have the opportunity to work and go to school and other opportunities. The Developmental Disabilities Act really talks about how you get there. So when you look at the issue of, you will find a section in the Developmental Disabilities Act, excuse me, talking about what self-determination is. You know, it's the ability to make choices, to solve problems, to be very active in choosing not only where you live, but how you live.
Do you or a loved one have a disability? What struggles with disabilities have you faced, and what do you want to see changed? You can join the conversation at 816-235-2888. You can also send us an email at centralstandard@kcur. Again, our phone number is 816-235-2888. And, Mike, I wanted to get back to a point you had made about folks with developmental disabilities at one time were institutionalized, and then that has become not as popular. You said centers were closed. Is that – are Kansas and Missouri also states that have closed most of those institutions?
I know more about Kansas, and the answer to that is yes. One of the largest state institutions in Winfield, Kansas, closed in the mid-1990s. And the remaining institutions are have very few. I mean, in the hundreds of folks who have been there a while and need have particular supports that right now are only available to them in a particular environment. So.
And Carl, I'm not sure if you could speak to Missouri and where Missouri is in that.
Sure.
Issue.
It's really an interesting transition process. Missouri has really focused on supporting the capacity of families to maintain children in their homes. So rather than just the strategy of closing facilities, which they have done to some degree, they're also building the capacity of the community and families to support individuals in their own homes. Missouri has, very interestingly, a Partnership for Hope waiver, where county funds, state funds, and federal funds can be invested to maintain somebody in their home and support families so that the mom can go to work and people can receive the services they want right in their own community. And so that's really been the focus.
And Kathy Fugger, is that something you'd want to weigh in on?
Yes. And with regards to young children, I think the whole concept is that the families are the decision makers and that supports are surrounding them in helping them help their children reach their goals. The First Steps program is the Birth to Three program that's federally sponsored. And our role has been as a support for the First Steps program. Through the years, we've helped with curriculum for them, help them with some of their understandings of the service coordination role, assisted with disseminating information about their early intervention teaming models. The other concept would be the inclusiveness of children in early learning programs, and that takes a lot of skill, and the concepts have been promoted in Missouri through the Special Quest program that started as a partnership of the Hilton Foundation and the Office of Head Start, and has taken root in a lot of areas throughout Missouri.
Well, Carl Calkins, you'd said that disabilities originally looked at what the deficits are, and now it's more about what they can add. Okay, I wonder if you could speak to that.
Yeah, it's a very intriguing concept. If you think of somebody in terms of either their challenges or their gifts, it's a very different way. You might introduce your son, this is my son who has a certain disability, or you might introduce your son of, this is my son who loves music, who loves to play the piano. And when you present somebody in that way, people have different perceptions of what they can do. So a lot is about our expectations, and a lot of the planning and program development focuses on the gifts and capacities that people have and kind of accommodates for what the deficits are.
Mike Waymar?
And to expand on that, I think we're at a point in time where the possibility of creating forms of support that enable people to function quite successfully across multiple environments is unique. The use of technology to enable people to do things that otherwise they might not be able to do as effectively is something that both benefits all of us, our smartphones, our supports for most of us in this day and age, but the same kinds of technology can support somebody. And, you know, we see this in day-to-day life. In years past, in order to be a checker at a grocery store, you had to be able to do some level of math. You had to be able to operate, to make change. If you think about that, that's all computerized now. All you really have to do, we can set it up, so mostly what you have to do is scan a barcode. That's a different set, skill set. You know, we keep hearing about cars that drive themselves, and, you know, so technology is dramatically changing how successful people can be independent of what limitations they may have. And, you know, I think the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, one of the real benefits is that people had greater opportunity. As Carl said, it's a civil rights act. It's a protection against discrimination. More and more people with disabilities became visible in their communities, and people began to see that people with disabilities can actually do things as opposed to old models that viewed people with disabilities as in some way broken or, you know, atypical or aberrant. And so these newer ways of thinking about disability emphasize personal capacity. What is it that people can do? Because everyone has strengths. Everyone has things they can do. And the demands of the environment. What can you do to modify and change the environment so that a person can be successful? And can you enhance their skills and capacity as well?
I wanted to have you talk a little bit more about self-determination, kind of flesh that out as an idea. I know that Carl Calkins and Mike Waymeyer, your organizations are members of a leadership consortium to promote self-determination. And could you talk about kind of the idea of self-determination when it seems like you hear it maybe starting in the 90s kind of percolating? And just a little bit about how it started being used and really kind of embraced.
Well, Mike is the most avid historian tracking self-determination. But just to provide the context, the Federal Administration on Developmental Disabilities identified self-determination after talking to a group of parents and national leaders as to what could they invest in over a 5-year period that would really build the field and the capacity of the field. So they funded a 5-year study, really a national training initiative on self-determination. Excuse me. And Mike and I were successful in not only getting the grant but building a partnership with other national leaders. And maybe you want to talk about that one.
Sure. If you go back to the late 80s, there was a federal emphasis on transition. Youth with disabilities had gained access to free appropriate public education. And so the next question was, so what? What does that mean? And the logical thing was, these young people needed to take advantage of that education and move to real jobs and real lives in their communities. And so what research showed in the late 80s was that there was something missing, that youth were not as successful as they should have been. And part of what was missing is that people were always doing things to and for people with disabilities. And if you think about systems that often support people with disabilities, they're very bureaucratic. They do things and impose on people. And so there was an emphasis in the early 90s on creating, opportunities for young people at school. Think about the number of decisions and choices that a typical high school student makes. And then if you know what the lives of a high school student with, a Down syndrome or intellectual disability might be, you know that they are provided fewer options to make choices and to make decisions. And it's sort of a vicious cycle. If you don't have those opportunities, you don't know how to do these things. So, in order to learn how to live in your community, you have to learn how to solve little problems that come up day in and day out. You have to learn how to, in order to be successful, you need to learn how to set goals. And you need, and of course, all of us want to pursue things that are of interest to us. And so this whole movement and this whole focus is on really enabling people with disabilities to make things happen in their own lives as opposed to somebody else doing things to and for them. It doesn't mean that they have to do everything themselves. I use a tax accountant. I pay some kid to mow the lawn. I don't have to do everything myself. It's that I make those decisions. I'm involved in those things. And what the research clearly shows is that young people with disabilities, across disabilities, who leave high school as more self-determined young people, achieve more positive employment and independent living outcomes. They experience a higher quality of life. It makes sense because, I think all of us are more motivated to pursue things if they're part of our goals and part of what we want to do.
It seems like in some ways that might be challenging for a parent in terms of a mindset as a child transitions into adulthood, moving away from being that decision maker to really putting the decision making process onto that person. And I don't know if any of you would like to respond to that. But
Actually, it might even be the opposite, that families are really challenged about what to do and provide supports for their children with disabilities. So if you would look at a framework or promoting self-determination as providing guidance, it's a wonderful way to proceed from early childhood all the way through teenage years and adulthood. if you make choices in your life, if you take responsibility for your action, if you're engaged in making decisions that affect you at any level, it really provides wonderful guidance. So, and actually people with individuals with disabilities and family members actively promote self-determination.
Yeah. Well, and I think, I mean, almost every parent wants what's best for their son or daughter. I mean, that's the ultimate thing. They want what's best. They want their son or daughter to live full, rich lives. And so if you are the parent of a child with a disability, and if you've been told all your life that your son or daughter won't be able to do anything and that you need to, you know, and there are concerns about protection and risk and safety, but that's true for, I'm the parent of two adolescent boys, and, you know, I have those concerns as well. They're exacerbated for people with, for parents and families, but, you know, it is difficult. It's difficult for everyone, though.
We'll get back to more of this conversation in just a minute. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to Central Standard. We're talking about disability issues today. You just heard from Dr. Mike Waymeyer of the Kansas University Center on Developmental Disabilities. Also in the studio, Dr. Kathy Fugger and Dr. Carl Calkins of the UMKC Institute for Human Development. When we return, we'll talk more about self-determination, and we'll take your calls. What do you think Kansas City should be doing better when it comes to disability issues? Our number is 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also email us at centralstandard@kcur.org or join the conversation on Facebook. Central Standard returns in a moment. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Laura Spencer. Kansas Senator Bob Dole and Iowa Senator Tom Harkin were two champions of the Americans with Disabilities Act that passed in 1990. At the time, Senator Harkin said, "Persons with disabilities ought to be judged on the basis of their abilities. They should not be judged nor discriminated against based on unfounded fear, prejudice, ignorance, or mythologies." The ADA and other legislation since that time has opened some doors, but not for all for people with disabilities. Some view self-determination and self-advocacy as a way for people with disabilities to bridge the gap. We're talking about disability issues today. Our guest, Dr. Carl Calkins, director of the UMKC Center for Human Development and a professor of psychology. Also, Mike Waymeyer, director of KU's Center on Developmental Disabilities and professor of special education. And Dr. Kathy Fugger, the director of the Early Childhood and Youth Programs at the UMKC Institute for Human Development. Thanks for staying with us. Appreciate you being here.
Thank you.
We were talking just before the break about self-determination, and Dr. Kathy Fugger, you wanted to talk a little bit about kind of the early interventions and how that contributes to self-determination.
Yes, I think the important thing about early intervention is that children's brains and bodies are growing and changing at the fastest rate they ever will. And so all the support to identify and address disability issues early is usually results in some very good outcomes. But one of the biggest outcomes really is helping families with goal planning on behalf of the children. And the newer ways of doing those interventions are by helping families think through their own typical family routines and how do they build support in for their children with disabilities that doesn't disrupt and take over all the rest of their family life. And similarly, in their early learning programs, in their churches, in their community, how are there ways that that support is built and strengthened so that everyone in society sees young children with disabilities and considers this part of the spectrum of what society is? We found that in early childhood programs, if other children are exposed to the issues and needs of children with disabilities, they gain a lot of strengths by learning how to adapt and make changes in the way they interact. And it just builds a more inclusive society from early childhood on up, where self-determination then becomes part of the norm of society from day one.
Do you have a family member with a disability? What actions have you been taking to achieve self-determination in your life or your family members? Give us a call. It's 816-235-2888, or you can send us an email at centralstandard@kcur.org. And Hawkeye is on the line from Overland Park.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Thanks for calling today.
Yes, fascinating topic, and I was curious to know if there is any dialogue going on in the disabled community about sexual intimacy of disabled people. You know, as you know, we are sexual beings, and sexuality is one of the most important things in human life. It appears to me that in America, and especially in the Midwest, sexuality per se is you know, somewhat of a taboo topic, and when it comes to a disabled person who is not able to, on his own or her own, go out and obtain any sexual experience, what would you say to a you know, to that topic, and if that is even being discussed, and if the religious heads would not explode here in Midwest when things like that even are being touched upon?
Okay, thanks, Hawkeye, and it looks like Mike Wehmeyer has a response.
Sure. Well, you know, people with disabilities are people first, and they are sexual beings. And, you know, intimate relationships with people who you care about and who are part of your life are what make most of our lives richer in so many ways. And so very much these issues of self-determination are part of an empowerment movement, a civil rights movement. We're very interested in it and work very hard to listen to people with disabilities about what is important to them. And, of course, people with disabilities say time and again that these kinds of intimate, meaningful relationships, including sexual activity, are important to them. And I think it is incumbent upon our systems aren't set up to deal with that, quite frankly. They're set up to deal with models of older, larger congregate. There are good people who are working very hard in systems to figure out how do you provide supports. And, of course, in anything like sexuality, these are very individual decisions, and the kinds of supports that would need to be provided and in place will vary very much according to the person.
Carl?
The issue of sexuality in individuals with disabilities is very interesting because statistics show that, you know, one in every four girls may be raped or abused by the time she's 18, one in every five boys. And the rate for individuals with disabilities is much higher. And so not only is it a risk area, but it parallels the conversation that we're having about self-determination, the ability to make choices in your life, the ability to say no, the ability to be prepared for different environments and what challenges you may face in those. And so I just want to point out that probably one of the most stellar programs in the country is MOXA, Metropolitan Organization to Counter Sexual Assault. We've partnered with them for years, and Rose Brooks Centers, to not only build prevention programs, but build the ability of both families and individuals with disabilities to make choices in their lives. And so there's good training programs, and actually, we have a lot to be proud of in the Midwest because our people not only aware of some of the challenges, but they have very supportive programs.
And Mike?
Yes, and I think in many cases, these issues that Carl raises, which are very real and very frightening, if you're a family member with a son or a daughter with a disability, if you're a person with a disability, those tend to be sort of conversation stoppers in many places. Oh no, we're scared of this, so we're not going to let anything happen. And I think the key is, this is a good example. I have some colleagues out of Columbia University in New York City, women with intellectual disability, who lived in the service systems in New York City, a large system, obviously. Were more likely or more prone to be victims of domestic abuse and including sexual assault. And so one of the interventions, I mean, so you can choose to just lock people up, but that's not a very rich, full life. So the interventions that they put into place were teaching these women how to recognize circumstances in which they might place themselves at greater risk for domestic or sexual assault. And these are basic problem-solving and decision-making skills. There's been work with mothers with intellectual disability. Again, this issue of being a parent if you have an intellectual disability has been a taboo. People don't want to talk about it. But the fact of the matter is, a lot of parenting is learning problem-solving skills. What do I do? My child's temperature is 101. When do I go to the hospital? And, of course, those of us who have been parents know that those are all squishy decisions. We never know. But there's been work showing that we can that mothers with intellectual disability can learn how to solve those kinds of problems. When is it that I take my child to the doctor? When do I not need to do that? So it really is, again, changing expectations about what people should do. Instead of letting what are genuinely horrific outcomes be the standard by which everyone's opportunities are based versus trying to provide people with the supports and the skills they need.
One of the issues we touched on briefly earlier was technology and how it's had a large impact. And you mentioned a person who's intellectually disabled who's pregnant. And I would think that there are applications that can remind people that they need to go to the doctor. And I would think in that case, that would be an extremely useful tool to have.
Absolutely.
Again, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. Do you or a loved one have a disability? You can join our conversation at 816-235-2888 or on Facebook. Brandon's calling from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning, Brandon.
Good morning. How are you?
Just fine. How are you?
Good. I wanted to call in today because I work at a nonprofit art studio in the Crossroads District of Kansas City. We opened last April, and so the past year, seeing how we work with adults with developmental disabilities, but seeing how art is a great way for individuals to kind of think independently and like really utilize, you know, some of the things that have happened in their past. To kind of have a free space where they can create has been really beneficial. And also the sense of, like, really being an individual and kind of, like, we have First Friday shows, so they sell their artwork, and it's kind of like another way, like, they see it as, like, a job. I don't know. I just wanted to share that, like, it's been a really good experience, and I've seen a lot of great changes happen in this past year.
How did you decide to focus on the population of disabled adults as a in this program?
We're part of a larger organization called Resources for Human Development, and in the state of Missouri, they focus on adults with developmental disabilities. So there's three art studios in St. Louis, and there's one that just opened in Kansas City this past April, which is where I work at. But that's the focus for the state of Missouri. And we also do residential supports. And I actually started off working residentially with an individual with autism for about 6 months until the art studio opened.
Okay, great. Well, thanks, Brandon, for sharing that information.
Yeah, thank you.
I would this issue of involvement with the arts is sort of a unique way to, first of all, it's raising expectations, giving people both opportunities to figure out whether they like the arts and whether they have any gifts or talents in the arts. But there are we've worked with folks who have very limited communication abilities. And with the ease of digital cameras in this day and age, and of course your smartphone is a digital camera, people can learn to use digital cameras, and they could do the same thing with art to portray emotions and thoughts and opinions and preferences that they might not otherwise be able to to express in traditional form. So the arts can, I think, have a real promising way to enable people to express their personal preferences in ways that other areas don't. So keep after it, Brandon.
Well, he touched briefly on jobs, and could you talk about how self-determination helps the disabled find and retain jobs? And are jobs in the arts common, or are they in other fields, Carl?
Boy, that's a really good question. You know, I'd like to just jump back a little to the issue of technology too, and Mike can talk about an iPad application that we've been working on to train people in the area of employment and self-determination. And maybe you could talk about how that might work and where we're going with it.
The expectation at this point in time should be that people can work in meaningful jobs. Employment is such an important thing for us as people for so many ways. It not only provides the resources in terms of money that we need to do all the other things we want to do in our lives, but it's how we meet people. As you're an adult, many of your friendships develop through the people you work with. And so being denied opportunities to work or to work only in places where other people with disabilities work denies people those opportunities to have those experiences, create those friendships. So employment is a really important aspect. And, you know, the way that learning how to set goals and to be engaged in problem solving around employment, there are lots of ways that leads to both obtaining jobs. So Carl mentioned we created an iPad app as part of our project that works with people to engage in planning with a focus on employment and community living and enables people to begin to talk about what it is they prefer. Because if you know, we want to start with what people like to do. A quick example, we worked with a young man years ago, and we were working through this process to help him identify some recreation or leisure goal. Young people don't want to set goals around math and science, so we work with them first on recreation and leisure. And this young man had wanted to be a storm chaser. And of course, those of us in the Midwest know what storm chasers are. So, but we also knew that there were reasons that wasn't going to happen for him. But because he expressed that preference, it got us looking at different ways. And what we discovered was that in the area we were working in, there were actually clubs of people who were storm chasers. And so his goal became to join one of these clubs, and he was able to do that, and it he was also then making connections with people who probably had a lot of money and could, you know, might be employers. So when you get into these kinds of goal setting and identifying personal interests and identifying what you're good at, I mean, that's what college is. You identify what you like to do and you identify what you're good at and you spend time getting better at that.
Well, an issue or a field that's really growing is STEM, with science, technology, engineering, and math. But people with disabilities are still underrepresented in that field, as far as I've read. Is that right, Mike or Carl?
Maybe not.
Okay.
Actually, we have an intriguing project at the Institute. It's a partnership funded by the National Science Foundation, working with the School of Computing and Engineering, to bring in disabled veterans and other persons with disabilities into the STEM field. This is a really exciting project and probably the topic for a whole nother show. But it's very interesting. The adaptive supports that people with disabilities may need in learning environments is very intriguing, from using iPads and recording lectures to actually adaptive curriculum. And that's what I was going back to in the area of employment. We're working on Actually, Micah's just developed an iPad application in a couple of areas. One's under development, but where you interact with a computer, and it asks you questions and engages you in ways of learning that are very attractive to people with disabilities. And so we actually have another iPad application out of this project in the area of healthcare, where it takes you through and shows you pictures, helps you make choices about appropriate decisions in healthcare in your life. So,
so it really helps with self-advocacy and self-determination.
It does. We've got a
full switchboard, so I'm going to go to some folks who are on the line who have called 816-235-2888. Again, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. And Judy's calling from Cleveland, Missouri. Good morning, Judy.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling in. You have do you host a website? Is that right?
I have an acquaintance who has started a website, and it is outofstep.com, and it is an online marketplace for people with disabilities to market their products and services. And you know, this is an effort that's near and dear to her heart. She lost a daughter who had disabilities and wants to help folks emphasize what they're good at rather than what they can't do. And this has just been launched within the last couple of months, and it's nationwide, and it's called outofstep.com.
Okay, thanks. Well, thanks so much for calling today, Judy. Again, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR. We're talking about disability issues. Our guests, Dr. Kathy Fugger and Dr. Carol Calkins of the UMKC Institute for Human Development, and Mike Waymeyer of the Kansas University Center on Developmental Disabilities. You can join the conversation at 816-235-2888 or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. And Judy's on the line from Lawrence. Good morning, Judy. Hello, Judy? Okay, it looks like we lost Judy, but we'll go to Laura in Leawood. And you have a question about caregivers who are taking care of someone who's developmentally disabled. Okay. Kathy, you look like you wanted to... did you have a comment about... Are you seeing more kids in using these technologies? It seems like developing apps are something that people from young ages are starting to use. Are you seeing some of the kids that you're working with also using these apps, or are they more for adults that you've seen?
I think a lot of technology is moving down through the lower elementary grades as well. It's not an area of my expertise, but certainly I think it's... allowing again for that equalizing of opportunities at a much earlier age.
Okay, we've got Stephanie calling from Lenexa. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning. My daughter has been diagnosed with a behavior disorder, disruptive behavior disorder, and developmental delay. Actually, at the KU Center, and we have had the hardest time trying to find preschools. She tends to do okay during the school day, but we really wanted a preschool that's academically challenging and also understands some of the needs of kids with a developmental delay and behavior challenges. Strong will is what they generally say about her. I didn't know if you all would have recommendations on those, both inside the 435 loop and outside.
Okay, this is a question for Kathy Fugger.
I don't have a specific recommendation for you, but a lot of the system-level work that's going on in both Kansas and Missouri involves improving the quality of early learning programs for all children. And it's almost always true that when a program is strong, effective, has well-trained teachers, and has good class ratio and varieties of meaningful experiences for all children, that's the setting where children with disabilities also thrive. We do know that children with behavioral disorders have a much higher rate of being kicked out of even preschool. And we all in the field think that that is a clear sign that we need to have high standards for early childhood education, which is challenging because it's still a low-paying field, and there are many complications of how we get from the place where we are today to where we need to be to give the best opportunities for children at the times that they're growing and changing the most.
Carl?
You might also go to our website at the Institute and go to moddrc.com, which is a resource center for families. We typically describe resources in Missouri, but we're so close that there's good partnerships there. So that may be helpful.
Okay. Brandy's calling. She has a question about her brother. Brandy, good morning.
Hi. 2 years ago, my mom and her youngest son moved in with me just because of resources. They had no place else to go. And he's had emotional disabilities and learning disabilities forever, and it's always been a struggle. And of course they pushed him through school so he graduated, but he has no desire to do anything. He's 24 and he sleeps all day, and I can't, since he's an adult, my hands are really tied as far as making him do something. I don't know what to do or where to go.
So it sounds like a question of how do you begin to teach someone or teach them self-determination skills? I mean, it sounds like the kind of a perfect candidate for that. I don't know if Mike or Carl, you want to chime in?
Well, I'd start off right at the beginning saying that when you approach issues like this, it may or may not be a disability question. I mean, I've heard other parents of 24-year-old children describe some similar situation. However, I think the real issue is engagement. And if you look at promoting self-determination in an individual's lives, the more that you practice it, the more they get engaged in making choices. And it's a slow process. Mike?
I would just say there's almost certainly something out there that your brother would be more interested in doing than laying on the sofa, but he doesn't know it. And so I would agree with Carl. And if you'll go to our website, ngsd.org, there's resources on how you might, maybe beginning by planning. Work with your brother to plan for something different. And there's some resources around planning that are available there.
And we'll have that information on our website, too, at kcur.org. Our guest today, you just heard from Dr. Mike Waymire of the Kansas University Center on Developmental Disabilities, also Dr. Carl Calkins of the UMKC Center for Human Development, and Dr. Kathy Fugger, also from the UMKC Center for Human Development. Thank you so much. I'm Laura Spencer, and this is Central Standard.